Now to the next case on the docket. We have next United States v. Caro Brown, 20-2787. Okay, thank you very much. Ms. Corbett, I understand that you have reserved 2 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes, I have.
Okay, please proceed.
Good morning. My name is Molly Corbett. I'm with the Federal Public Defender Office in the Northern District of New York, and I represent the appellant, Caro Brown. The District Court abused its discretion in denying a reduction in sentence pursuant to 404B of the First Step Act in applying a different sentence calculation under the guidelines, recalculating the sentencing range, and failing to accurately account for the jury determinations and a lack of jury determination related to the specific offenses of murder, attempted murder, and a conspiracy under New York state law. In recalculating the guideline, the District Court turned away from the drug sentencing guidelines and used the murder guideline under 2A1.1.
And what exactly was the problem with doing that, specifically?
In doing that, Your Honor, it relied on murders that were not specifically attributed to Mr. Brown.
Well, wasn't there a finding here that he was a member of the gang and that the gang was violent? And they weren't. And that was also a factor in the earlier sentencing as well. Under those circumstances, why wouldn't the district judge be fully able to hold him accountable for the crimes that were committed by in furtherance of the enterprise?
The crimes that were included within the jury determination were murder, attempted murder, and conspiracy.
Right.
The murder and the conspiracy components under New York law did carry a life sentence. Unfortunately, the attempted murder component did not.
That seems like that's a different argument. So you were saying he switched from the drug crime to the murder
right.
crime. But in fact, when you're doing the guidelines for a RICO offense, you look at the underlying conduct and determine which one is higher, right? So in this exercise that he's doing where he's deciding, well, if we applied the current guidelines to that conduct, it turns out that the murder-related conduct has a higher offense level. There's nothing wrong with that. I understand we'll talk about whether he calculated the murder-related activity properly, but there's nothing wrong with that calculation. In fact, in his first proceeding, the PSR did that. It looked at the murder-related activity, looked at the drug-related activity, and then determined which one had the higher offense level.
Right. In doing that, he did.
So that's fine, right? And so now you're saying the problem is that he assumed that your client had been convicted of murder, participating in a enterprise that had engaged in murder as opposed to one that engaged in attempted murder or conspiracy.
Exactly.
But so, was he limited to the findings of the jury? I understand the jury made limited findings, but of course, just like the PSR in the first proceeding could look at what the facts suggested, wasn't he entitled to do that here too?
Well, in this instance, there was no determination as to the specifics of the actual New York offense that he had agreed to commit. So there was a finding that it was murder, attempted murder, or conspiracy involving somebody under the age of 16, I believe, in a felony offense. So in doing so, the judge made additional factual findings that Mr. Brown either had been conspiring in murders or conspiracy to commit a felony with a minor without those findings having been made by the jury.
So can I just ask to clarify, I think I understand your argument, but let me just restate it and you tell me if I'm getting it right. The district court was perfectly entitled to make any of those findings he wanted to the extent he was not increasing the statutory penalty. So if he's only operating within the guidelines, he can make a finding that he murdered people, conspired, attempted to murder, whatever. But now, for purposes of recalculating the guidelines, you've got to go through not just Chapter 1 and Chapter 2 and Chapter 3. And if we're in Chapter 2, we're applying the murder guideline. through the bracketeering, and we've got our offense levels up in the 40s. But you've got to go all the way to 5G 1.1, which says whatever your guideline range is going to be capped at the statutory max. And because of the drug conspiracy with its life dropped out, we have to take the lowest common denominator murder case or murder charge, which would be the 25-year max attempted murder under New York law, so that you're capped at 240. So the guideline range, if one recalculates the original guidelines by only changing, dropping out the old version of the drug conspiracy guidelines, you now wind up at a guideline range of 240 flat.
That's correct.
Okay, so that's your argument. So he's, the district judge, perfectly entitled to make factual findings within the guidelines world, but to the extent that 5G 1.1 imports into its guideline analysis the statutory max that would be applicable, the court can't make findings other than what we know is the minimum the jury made, so that way you've got your cap of 20 years.
That's right. And that's reflected in the cautionary tales of Gennady and in the case, the Sixth Circuit case that it relied on in Corrado. So in making that additional determination, it exceeded the statutory, what was the statutory limits.
Are you talking about the first sentencing or the second sentencing?
I'm talking about the second, the resentencing.
And how did this differ from the first? Did he not make that finding in the first time?
He did not make the finding about the specific murder, attempted murder, or what could actually be attributed to Mr. Brown. Instead, he relied solely on the drug calculations and the drug guidelines.
And am I correct that even if he had made those findings at the original sentencing, which would have been perfectly within his purview because we're dealing with the statutory maximum of life, at the time of the First Step Act consideration, in reconsidering the guidelines, he would be obliged to take notice of the fact that the statutory maximum would have come down to 20 when recalculating the guidelines pursuant to Moore. So at that point, any factual findings, even had he made them at the original sentencing, which it doesn't look like he did, distinguishing among the three types of murder, that would not have had any consequence on what the statutory max would have been. That would have only been the sort of thing, I don't know, I suppose if the three types of murder would have generated different offense levels, then I suppose that would have been fine. But that's not where we are now. Where we are now is figuring out what the new statutory max would have been in determining the calculation under the guidelines. So if that is the case, if that is your position, what is your view as to whether there would be any argument regarding harmlessness? The district court was rather emphatic about the severity of your client's criminal history, particularly shooting people point blank and not killing them only through the fortuity that the gun jammed, things like that. The court was under the impression that he could have gone down as low as 360 months from 480 and wanted no part of that. Why should we think there's any chance that if the district court knew the proper guideline range was 240 instead of 360 to life, that there's any chance the district court would have had any interest in exercising its discretion to go below 480?
Well, I think that goes to the other component of my argument, which is, although that it's not necessary that the district court consider the 3553A factors, in this case, the court did consider a number of the 3553A factors. But it did so in a way that only reflected the negative history of Mr. Brown. So as far as his criminal history, I had put forth that there were mistakes in his criminal history and that there were subsequent...
Isn't that water under the bridge, though? Under Moore, we said you don't get to recalculate the guidelines. You don't get to relitigate the original sentencing, except to the extent that the Fair Sentencing Act changes would flow through. So this is not a plenary resentencing, right? You don't get to go back and say, well, we didn't fight criminal history category back at the original sentencing, but we'd like to raise some of those new issues now. We said district court doesn't have to do that.
The district court doesn't have to do that, but under Moore and Moyne-Hernandez, if the court does consider or does use 3553A factors as guidelines in recalculating or re-examining its prior sentencing determinations under 404B, it should do so in a wholesome way that accurately.
No, that's not our law, is it? I mean, I think that. It's presumed that the judge, we start off with a presumption that the judges act under 355A, even when they don't say anything other than I've looked at 355A and I'm sentencing in compliance with that. There's no robotic incantation requirement. And why would that change? Because the judge has singled out a particular factor and emphasized that.
Well, Judge Walker, I agree. There is no requirement for a robotic incantation, but the reality of this examination and decision by this court in determining not to resentence was that it contained errors. And those errors, I believe, colored the rest of the court's discretion in examining what it would do. It went back.
So the 3553A factors analysis contained errors. And so it's not that the guidelines calculation we're just talking about is decisive. It's the 3553A.
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
So the reason you want to send it back is because of the errors in the 3553A calculation or consideration.
But and the my understanding is that you were arguing that and the guidelines error both.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Would one be sufficient without the other, or somehow both of them together is what leads to the requirement to send it back?
I believe that the sentencing cap calculation is the most important error, and then the factual determination that Mr. Brown was in fact responsible for three murders when he was in fact in jail for two and a fugitive for one.
So you're making two independent arguments, but I would understand you to saying you think both the errors were made. Either one would justify vacating and remanding. And certainly if we were to agree with you on both points, that would just be belt and suspenders reasons to vacate.
Right. It would be a true abuse of discretion of the court's authority under 404B. In addition, the court didn't even go back to a recalculation of the drug guidelines as far as how it was affected.
Well, and it ought not to, right? If its calculation of the murder guidelines was appropriate, then it would trump whatever you get under the drug guidelines anyway. It would just know that the drug guidelines dropped below murder. Murder, as originally found at the original sentencing, those guidelines will then drive the bus for RICO. And then what follows is simply a matter of math, 240 months. So would your view then be that in light of that guidelines miscalculation, if we were to agree with you on that, that our precedent would require a vacate and remand for the simple fact that the guidelines are supposed to have a certain, I don't know, say gravitational pull. And if the district court had known that the guidelines would be down to 240 instead of 360, then who knows whether the district court might have exercised its discretion in a different way?
That is part of the argument, and specifically for this district court judge who has in other 404B resentencing, including life imprisonment cases and under CCD, has reduced the sentences below.
Does that analysis about gravitational pull, does it apply when the district judge isn't even required to calculate the guidelines in this context? I mean, we usually say that in context where that's a required part of the analysis.
Well, one would hope that each of the 3553A factors, including a sentencing range under the guidelines, would have equal balance amongst the court's discretion. But I think Booker is reflective of the fact that the sentencing guidelines have always had gravitational pull,
And the theory here is more we said, and more we said you do have to recalculate the guidelines, but only in that limited way that you've laid out here.
As is Section 2 of the Fair Sentencing Act.
Which would flow through to a new guideline range of 240. Not allowing you to recalculate anything else, not allowing you to recalculate or relitigate the criminal history category, but just to the extent that the FSA flowed through, you would yield a guideline range of 240, right?
That's correct.
You reserved 2 minutes. Why don't we hear from the government? And Mr. Desange, if I could just impose on you to pick up on that last point. I guess the first question that's not entirely clear to me is what is the government's position on how the guidelines would have been properly recalculated to the limited extent dictated by Moore in this case? Do you agree that they should have been 240 rather than 360?
No, Your Honor.
So could you just explain that, please?
On page 47 of our brief, I note that the jury made a finding as to the quantity of drugs involved in racketeering enterprise, 1.5 kilograms.
No, I'm sorry.
No, we're not talking about drugs.
Yeah.
Murder.
Yeah, I'm talking about the statutory max. Because, again, as I read the district court's opinion in the First Step Act, I thought it was a little jumbled. For one thing, he started to make factual findings about what kind of murder was committed, or maybe he thought the jury had made findings. Put that aside. We now know from Davis and all these other cases, we can't rely on factual findings about the underlying conduct in the drug cases to keep your drug statutory max at life. Would you agree with that, or is your view that because the district court made factual findings, the statutory max on the B1A predicate still is life and still drives the RICO statutory max?
No, maybe I'm familiar with the case law you're citing, but my understanding is that we have to look here at the statutory maximum can be determined from either the drug conduct.
Right, and we know that the B1A is now dropped down to 5 to 40 from 20 to life, right? By virtue of the First Step Act, right? We can't use the jury finding of 1.5 kilos.
Well,
that's not an element of the offense.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, that's a mistake that I made in my brief, because that's correct. My understanding is that the maximum is still life, but that's not.
So I guess I'm just trying to, and that's fair, maybe that is the case, but I'm trying to understand why that's true. I thought in Davis and in all these cases now, the courts have said we have to use an elements-based approach. We can't use a case-by-case fact-based approach. So even though I understand that this was one of those strange cases decided right around Blakely when nobody knew what was going to happen in the future with Booker and the juries were being asked as a precautionary matter to make all sorts of findings beyond a reasonable doubt, and they found 1.5 kilos, it's still not an element. So if we're stuck with an elements approach, it seems like that special jury verdict is surplusage.
Again, Your Honor, I may be misunderstanding a lot, but my understanding of the categorical approach still allows you to look at the jury finding as a quantity.
But the categorical approach, I thought, allows you to determine what are the elements. But if you have special findings, like 1.5 kilos, that don't correspond to any element of any crime, right? There never was a version of B1A that was triggered by 1.5 kilos, right? Wasn't it 50 grams?
It was 50, and I thought it was 280 or more.
Right. So at no point was there ever a threshold called 1.5 kilos.
Right. But my understanding is if you're talking about predicate offenses that qualify you for recidivism enhancement, the categorical approach applies. But you still can rely on jury findings to see where you fall in the B1A category.
Even if they're not findings of elements.
Well, I may be incorrect. Your Honor, I think the bigger point is the one that you were making earlier. The judge here made very clear at the end of his decision that even if the guidelines were lower here, given the severity of Mr. Brown's conduct, he wouldn't have lowered the sentence here. And as far as...
Are you saying, I'm sorry, on that last point, are you talking about even assuming that the defense is correct, that your statutory max comes down to 20,
right,
and that you're dealing with a guideline range of 240. Are you now making the argument that basically would have been a harmless error because the district court made it so clear that the defendant's criminal history was so atrocious here? If he wasn't going to come down when he knew he could go down to 360, there's certainly no way he was going to come down just because the guideline range was 240.
Correct, Your Honor. Again,
but what do you do with the gravitational pull argument that the other side's making?
Well, I think, Your Honor, if there's any doubt in the court's mind, then I think a limited remand would be appropriate just to ask the judge, if it was 240, would you have denied the plea? I don't think that he's entitled to plenary resentencing and reopening the PSR as
to— Oh, no. I mean, Moore is pretty clear on that, and subsequent cases.
Right. And so I think, as far as this, as the— if the court was inclined to remand for clarification of that, I think it would be very clear that the judge is entitled to rely on the PSR's findings, which are non-final. The defendant had many chances to address the application of the first-degree murder guideline here.
But it's not so much the application of the guideline. I mean, I understand they're making that argument. I don't quite see it. But again, that's Chapter 2, right? I'm wondering more about Chapter 5, when we get to 5G1.1, and you can have all these astronomical offense levels that would put you at 360 to life, but if we were not to agree with the government that the drug statutory max remains at life, but now B1A is a 5 to 40, the only thing that could trigger a statutory life sentence would be the murders, because the jury verdict was not specific. We've got to go with the lowest common denominator, which is a 25-year, meaning that the statutory max of the RICO remains at 20.
Correct.
Meaning under 5G1.1, the 360 to life range gets pulled down and capped with a ceiling of 20. If that's the case, I guess that seems to be the question here.
Right. And Your Honor, I think the judge was very clear that given the severity of the conduct, if you look at the PSR, the acts of violence here were attributable both to Mr. Brown in terms of shooting people, and also the question of whether, as part of the RICO conspiracy, whether acts of murder were foreseeable to him. They clearly were. He had recruited young members of the gang to enforce the gang's territory. He had directed someone to shoot another gang member who happened to miss the school bus. Those kind of factors are still very serious. The judge took them very seriously, and I think made it clear that he was not inclined to lower the sentence at all.
We were to remand, hypothetically, and I guess this will be a question for defense as well, I think you were suggesting that something along the lines of a Jacobson or Crosby remand would be appropriate, that we would hypothetically point out the guidelines error to the district judge and ask, had you known that the properly calculated guideline range under Moore was 240 months, would you have imposed a materially, or whatever, non-trivially different sentence? And if the answer was no, it's over. And if the answer is yes, the judge could then impose a different sentence. What is practically the difference about how that plays out, as opposed to us, if we were hypothetically simply to vacate and remand? Keeping in mind that we're already in a world that is a limited consideration. The First Step Act calls for a very limited proceeding. It seems different from a sentencing, where the difference is you have a Jacobson remand or we're reopening to a plenary resentencing. Well, we know that First Step Acts are not plenary resentencings. Are we just making things a little bit more complicated than they need to be by making it a Jacobson-Crosby situation?
Well, I think that the government has an interest that if the court were to remand, it would make clear that the judge, in the first instance, did not have to even recalculate the guidelines. That the First Step Act says he may sentence as if. It's only if the judge decides to resentence as if that we start to get into a new look at the guidelines. So we would just ask that the court make clear that—
So you're saying that the discretionary decision of the district court could precede the court's decision of whether to even follow the Moore procedure of recalculating the guidelines?
Correct, Your Honor, because if you're dealing with a defendant like this who's extremely violent, or, you know, another defendant who has engaged in incredibly serious conduct as part of the drug operation, has killed people, the judge shouldn't have to then jump through the hoop of looking at the guidelines under the First Step Act. The statute says you may do that, but it doesn't require it. And Section 4 of the C section says nothing in this act requires you to resentence. So I think we just want to make it very clear that a judge can just skip right back to the end point and say, look, I just don't think he should be serving any less time. He's not one of the defendants I think the act was designed to benefit.
And you think a judge could say that, saying, I don't even need to know what the Moore version of recalculated guidelines could be, even if they wound up being 0 to 6. I don't care. This fellow's criminal history, or whatever the reasons are so bad, I would not exercise my discretion under any circumstances.
Right. I think that.
But do we have that statement here? I guess that's, even if that's true. Do we have the district judge saying, even if they were 240, or even if they were, whatever, 41 and 51, I would not, we don't have that statement.
You're just saying that if there were a remand here, you wouldn't want the opinion to suggest that he was required to do this.
Right, this is a required step to go in and calculate the guidelines range again in the first step.
Does the fact that it wasn't required, that it was just it was discretionary on his part, does that affect the arguments about the gravitational pull and what we think about how it affects the sentence?
I can't get around the fact that what the judge thought he was doing was saying, he said, in order to determine whether I'm going to give him a sentence reduction, I'm going to look at the effect of the first step back. The judge made that decision. It's a discretionary decision. But the judge didn't do it. So that's what he said he was doing. So we were in that land. So I think if you do find that there's an error in terms of the ceiling, there's the statutory ceiling, I think a limited remand to ask the judge for at least a remand that is clear that in broad scope of these cases, there's no requirement. But here, having done that, this is the explanation you gave, would it have changed had you known that there was a 240 cap? So if that's what the court determines. I think the broader interest of the government is that more says that if you're going to look at the effect of the First Step Act, then you have a very limited requirement to recalculate the guidelines. But the government believes that a judge, because there's so many of these motions, I think Congress is very careful not to impose these very onerous or kind of resentencing-like proceedings for the judge. Other judges can just sigh and say, look, I know this defendant, and I don't believe he deserves any reduction under the First Step Act.
Can I ask you just one other question, I guess? I don't know if you're prepared to answer this or not. But how many of these are pending anymore in the district courts? My impression is that almost all of them have been resolved, and because, unlike, say, the compassionate release ones where you can keep following, with these, you can only file one, and upon complete review of the merits, you can no longer file another one. Sometimes I wonder, you know, how many cases are out there awaiting guidance from us, and how much is this completely water under the bridge at this late date? Do you have any sense of how many are pending in your district, if any?
I focus on appellate matters, right?
Sure.
I try to provide the court with some data.
No need. I was just curious. So thank you very much for your argument. I appreciate it. Ms. Corbett, I don't know if you have any sense, and if you don't, that's fine. We weren't expecting that. But do you have any sense of whether there are any or many pending in your district?
Well, I am the point of contact in the Northern District of New York for these requests, and I do at the moment have approximately 10 that are pending.
Oh, you do.
I will say that I have gotten additional inquiries based on the recent decision that found that dual object conspiracies are also eligible. So, as the court makes decisions more inmates and
okay, so that's helpful. Would you mind, I hate to impose on you, but could you address the sequencing question that we were talking about just there with Moore? about whether, as the government suggests, it would be perfectly appropriate for a district court to decide in the first instance, and I assume that's after determining eligibility, saying there are factors here which would lead me never to grant a sentencing reduction. Therefore, I need not engage in the exercise to begin with of recalculating the guidelines under Moore. What's your view on that?
Well, I think that the directive under 404B and 404C is that the sentence is to be reconsidered as if Section 2 applied. So as part of that...
Does it say that, though, or does it say the court may impose a reduced sentence as if? It doesn't. Does it say it must consider?
It does say may.
But it doesn't say it must consider this and then decide. It just says it may impose as if.
And continuing on into 404C, it also says this decision must be made after a full review. So what Congress intended with a full review is probably left to a little more legislative research not completed for this argument.
And there is none. There's no legislative history, even if you were interested. So your view would be embedded in the 404C requirement that there must be a complete review of the merits. Your argument would be that even though there are no specifications of what that phrase means, that in your view would necessarily include the Moore recalculation of the guidelines?
That, in addition to the use of the 3553A factors as guideposts, as members of the circuits have found, are relevant to this consideration. I will say,
why is that required by the language for review? I mean, if he looks at the whole record and decides that he doesn't think a reduction is justified, why isn't that a full review?
Well, as an appellate counsel, I would like to know what that review would tell, just so that there would be a record for us to examine as to whether or not the determinations that the court made were accurate and reliable. I just would like to just quickly speak to the court of a recent decision in the Fourth Circuit. It's U.S. v. Simmons, and it addresses the relevant elements of a RICO conspiracy and what must be found. And it's in the context of a categorical analysis, although unrelated to this, it's under an examination of what a violent felony is. And it specifically finds that a defendant must have committed the racketeering activity, as that term is defined under 1961, which is something that did not occur in this case. And I may follow us up with a 28-J letter.
Okay.
I request a complete vacation of remand for full consideration.
Okay. Thank you very much to both counsel. It was very well argued and very helpful. We will reserve decision. I think that brings us to a close today. We'd like to thank everyone for attending, both remotely and live, and we will now stand in recess.